Good morning, Colorado. You're listening to the Daily Sun Up with the Colorado Sun. It's Friday, September 9th. Today, we're talking with author Claire Boyles, who not only has terrific writing chops, but also has worked as a teacher and even tried her hand at farming. Before we begin, a quick message from our sponsors at Xcel Energy. Colorado has some of the nation's best wind and solar resources, and Xcel Energy is putting them to work for you. Their nation-leading wind energy expansion is reducing our carbon footprint while producing some of the lowest-cost electricity on the Colorado grid. Learn more at xcelenergy.com. Now, let's go back in time with some Colorado history. On this day, in 1960, the Denver Broncos defeated the Boston Patriots 13-10 in the very first American Football League game. The upstart league operated for 10 seasons between 1960 and 1970, before merging with the older NFL. Fierce competition between the two leagues resulted in the establishment of a common draft and a championship game that would eventually become the Super Bowl. That first matchup game set the tone for a fierce rivalry between the Broncos and the Patriots, with many notable moments. In 1986, Denver quarterback John Elway's first career playoff win was against New England. In 2005, the Broncos won their first playoff game since Elway's retirement, while also handing Tom Brady his first ever playoff loss. And in 2015, Peyton Manning's Broncos beat Brady's Patriots 20-18 in the AFC Championship game. The Broncos would go on to win the Super Bowl for the third time. Before we continue, the Colorado Sun is hosting a free virtual event to discuss the crisis of mental health in Colorado's youth. Join Colorado Sun reporters and experts on September 14th from 6 to 7 p.m. You can register today at coloradosun.com/events. Next, our feature story.
Hello, Colorado. As we continue to expand our Daily Sun Up podcast, we'll be talking with some of the many authors with Colorado connections who we've been fortunate enough to spotlight in our literary feature called Sunlit, where every Sunday we have a new excerpt and a new author interview. And today we're talking with author Claire Boyles, who not only has terrific writing chops, but also has worked as a teacher and even tried her hand at farming. Welcome, Claire.
Thank you for having me.
So first of all, let's talk about your most recent book, Site Fidelity, it's called, which was a finalist for this year's Colorado Book Award. And we were actually able to preview this last fall. We were a little ahead of the curve. And it's a collection of interconnected short stories, more or less revolving around the theme in the title. So tell us just exactly what does Site Fidelity mean and how did it come to be the focus of your book?
Site fidelity is a term from science, from the study of animals, and it describes the tendency of animals to return to the same place over and over again. Often it's a breeding behavior. They return to the same. I mean, we know that about salmon and different species. And I learned the term while I was doing research for the first story in the collection, which is titled Ledgers, which has a lot to do with the Gunnison sage grouse, which is a separate species of sage grouse that lives in southern Colorado and northern New Mexico, mostly around the Gunnison area. So I wrote that story, and I was writing the other stories, and it really kind of took a while. The collection had three or four different other terrible names, and finally, after sort of rewriting the stories a few times and thinking about the book as a whole, I realized that most of the stories were dealing with characters who were really connected to the places that they lived in some way or another, and that's sort of, I feel like when I knew the book was ready, when the title made sense and it felt like it encompassed the whole book rather than just being part of that one story.
So ultimately, this is a book with strong environmental underpinnings and that grew from your own experience trying your hand at sustainable farming in Weld County, which is I think your farm was, what, several miles east of Greeley?
Mm-hmm. Directly north of Kersey. So, yeah, east of north of Greeley, yeah.
And that's also an area that's very heavily dependent on the oil and gas industry. It's kind of interesting how oil and gas and agriculture are literally on top of each other there. So how did that farming experience evolve and sort of shape your vision for site fidelity?
We bought the land east of Greeley in 2008, early 2008, right before the value of that land really dropped in late 2008 in the Great Recession. And by 2013, we realized we had to sell. We were just kind of over our heads and still underwater pretty far. And so during that time, we were trying to grow sustainably. We were using organic practices. We were running animals to fertilize the land. We raised chickens and pigs and turkeys. And then we grew vegetables and cut flowers. We were just a really different operation, and we were doing a lot of direct marketing. And so that was it was difficult to convince people, especially during a recession, that the pricing of our food sort of included some environmental benefits, and that those environmental benefits were worth investing in as a community and as a society. And it was the same time, the recession, that oil and gas really boomed in Weld County. All around us were new fracking pads, and you could at one point stand in the middle of these 20 acres we had all these organic vegetables on and just turn in a circle, and it was flare stack after flare stack after flare stack. And I just started really thinking hard about what we value and what we're willing to invest in and what we aren't, which is really what led to a lot of the themes in the book, I think, and the ways the characters are interacting with the world around them.
Just offhand, did you have any mineral rights beneath your land? I wonder if you had to confront the quandary of, all right, do we take advantage of this or not?
No, we did not. The mineral rights had been sold off the land we had years before we bought it. So we did have a company come in and do seismic testing to see if our land, if they could drill on our land, which is not something we wanted, but was something we, you know, sort of not totally up to us. And so that was, it really, they didn't end up finding any good places or coming back to drill, but we did have some issues with, it sort of ruined some of our irrigation setup in the field because we had buried drip lines, and they sort of, we were like, please don't drive over those. They're like, we won't. And then they kind of did. There really wasn't anything we could do about it. So, they weren't used to it. You know, it's not something that's normal to have buried drip irrigation, or not at least at that time in Weld County. And so it got kind of lost in the shuffle.
So really, you're sort of the genesis of your writing for public consumption, at least, started as a result of the farm, right? When you had a vlog that tried to maybe explain some of the things that you were just describing to me.
Yeah, I started writing the blog in 2008 when we started the farm. I thought of it as sort of like a marketing tool, but it ended up being more of a writing discipline for me and a way that I was sort of making sense for myself of what was happening and what we were learning and what we were encountering. And then I started to realize that I didn't always, I mean, not for the blog. The blog was a, you know, nonfiction situation, but I started to realize that in fiction, you had just a lot more choices. And so I started experimenting with writing fiction. And that's sort of what led to the story Man Camp, which is in the collection. A version of that was the very first short story that I wrote. And I wrote it in our last couple years on the farm.
And so you were, I think, 36 when you wrote your first serious short story. And it's interesting, as I've worked on our Sunlit feature, I've noticed that many of the authors came to their writing well into adulthood, and sometimes even much later in life. Why do you think your writing epiphany, if we can call it that, came at the time that it did?
I think it was a combination of factors. One important piece for me was courage. I mean, I'd been taught my whole life sort of away from writing as something serious, you know, something you could make a career out of or something that should take up the amount of time that I was spending doing it. And I think as our farm was failing and I was realizing that that failure really didn't change who I was, it gave me some courage to be like, well, if I write these stories and no one ever wants to read them, it will still matter to me. The same way the farm really mattered to me. It's something I carry with me and that is really important to who I am as a person. So I think that's a big piece of it. Just sort of, I grew into it. I grew into feeling like it, the outcome wasn't as important as the act of writing. Everything that has happened since was sort of beyond my ambition. And I'm very grateful to have a book that's an object that I can hold in my hand. But it wasn't something I really totally believed in when I started writing. It just felt like something I had to do. I wanted to write those stories.
When the interview that we did with you last fall, you talked a little bit about your writing process. We always ask authors about that because I think it's fascinating the way different authors approach their craft. And you mentioned that you were doing some other things at that time. You were raising your kids, among other things, doing carpools and whatnot. So tell us a little more about just how you found the time to write and how you got comfortable with that. And it sounds like the experience ultimately served you well.
Yeah, I think that's something you learn. I learned anyway from farming is like the plants, you need to be in them every day. They need to be, even if they don't need any care, you need to put your eyes on them. You need to see what it looks like. So that sort of consistency, I don't write every day, but I did understand the importance of cultivating a practice and kind of keeping myself in the work that I was doing, even if it was just like 5 minutes here or half hour there. So yeah, I wrote while my kids were at basketball practice and like loud gyms and under trees at track meets between events. And one of the stories, Sister Agnes Mary in the year 2012, the first draft I wrote in the food court of a strip mall laser tag facility while I was just giving my like 9-year-old son and his friend quarters, just go do whatever. And I'm going to write this story. So I think out of necessity, I learned how to focus and concentrate in strange places. And that's something that served me very well. There was no other way to do it.
You know, when we first spoke about doing this podcast, you initially had a scheduling conflict, mainly that you would be unreachable for a few days because you're a Poudre Wilderness volunteer and you were out on patrol. How did you get into that and what does that entail? What does that mean?
I'm a first year Poudre Wilderness volunteer. This is my first season as a volunteer. The organization is, I think, over 30 years old. They've been around for a long time. And we are volunteers for the United States Forest Service, the Canyon Lakes Ranger District. And we train and then we hike the various trails. And mostly we do a lot of education for people and aid. So we make sure people have the water they need, the sunscreen, the maps, they know where they're going. A lot of times people will take pictures of the map that I have with me. And we also educate people on leave no trace principles. The organization also does a lot of trail restoration and trail building and noxious weed eradication and various care for the wilderness areas and the trails in that the Forest Service really just doesn't have the funding to do. So the volunteers step in. It's really the best volunteer situation I think I maybe have ever had. Get to be out in the world and talking to people in the forest. It's pretty fantastic.
Oh, that's great. Well, to switch gears back to literature, what are you working on now?
I am in the final stages, I hope, of my novel, which is titled Appraisals, which should be out next year from W.W. Norton, or maybe it's unclear. I hope 2023, but we'll see. And that is it's focused on farming. It follows the main character from her childhood when her grandparents lose their farm in the 1980s farm crisis, through losing her own farm in the recession into the present day when she is farming on land that a billionaire from Silicon Valley owns, sort of as a tax write-off for him, and various other challenges present themselves to her.
Well, finally, one of the things about your professional bio that jumped out at me is that you've written for the Hallmark Channel at least, I think at last count, two Christmas stories under the title Sister Swap. And I happen to live under the same roof as someone who absolutely can't get enough of the Hallmark Channel. Tell us how you happened into that role and how writing for TV like that is different from the stories you tell in literary fiction.
My brother is a screenwriter who has written many Hallmark Channel movies. He and I started writing and pitching TV ideas together back in 2010 while I was still on the farm, which is one of the ways I started writing fiction. I was writing it with my brother for TV before I was writing short stories or literary fiction. The Christmas romantic comedies are really fun to write, and they're fun to watch. I think I also love them. When my brother and I were writing the Sister Swap movies, actually, we were losing our father was battling cancer, and we were sort of having these caretaking responsibilities that were pretty heavy. And then we would go downstairs in July and it's 100 degrees, and we'd put Christmas carols on our headphones. And just for me, it just was really wonderful to be able to say, like, what is the most joyful, wonderful thing I can put on the page? Like, what will make people the happiest in this scene? I really think those movies and those stories are a really important form of art, like just as essential and just as important as literary fiction, even though they kind of serve different roles and sort of appeal to, I mean, I think there's overlap, but I think they tend to appeal for different reasons to different people. But for me, I love them both. Very much. My literary fiction, I'm definitely not always trying to delight people. So it's very fun to have this other form where that's really the main goal. What is delightful and fun about this story?
So what's it like to see characters on the screen bring your words to life? And then I wonder if you start thinking, oh, well, gee, how would I cast Sight Fidelity?
I mean, I don't think Sight Fidelity is really TV material. They're pretty quiet stories, maybe. But I will say it's a thrill to see the characters you've created and the worlds that we sort of built on the page, you know, interpreted on the screen. And there is this sort of extra level, lots of extra levels of art built into it, because we write the story, but then there's the crews that do the lighting and the costumes and the art department and the producers and the actors. And it becomes sort of a team project where everybody is sort of bringing their best skills. And that really, I think, amplifies the storytelling in a way that I found very wonderful. I was very proud of those movies, for sure.
We've been talking with author Claire Voyles, whose short story collection, Sight Fidelity, is out there in the world now and available at a bookstore near you. And it's a terrific read. I am in the middle of it right now, and it's all the stories are just as good as the excerpt that we ran back in the fall of last year. And it's from a remarkable Colorado talent. Thanks for joining us, Claire.
Oh, thank you so much, Kevin, for having me and for those really kind words about my book.
Read more at coloradosun.com. Finally, here are a few stories that you should know about today. Since 1980, the Colorado Division of Mining and the Forest Service have gated and plugged more than 13,000 inactive mines to protect hikers and wildlife. The safety measures often mean using expanding foam to seal off dangerous mines. Officials are increasingly using a mix of chemicals with resin that is poured out of bags. It then creates an exothermic reaction to fill cracks and crevices. Social media is also playing a role in locating mines that should be closed. Social posts often help officials identify openings that should be sealed, but the posts also draw more visitors to those sites. The Denver Zoo is taking steps to not just diversify its staff, but to make sure its visitors reflect the metro area. In 2011, Alonzo Ashley, a black man, died at the zoo after police tackled and hit him with a taser while he suffered from heat stroke. His death was brought back into public light after the murder of George Floyd and the ensuing Black Lives Matter protests. Since then, the zoo has put focus on diversity and inclusion plans in hopes of inspiring future generations to save wildlife. The developers behind a luxury home estate on 680 acres above the Vail Valley are suing the Forest Service to get an answer on whether they can build a more direct road to their proposed 19 homes. After a 14-year process, the lawsuit filed this week is asking a federal judge to force the Forest Service to issue its final decision, which should have been announced last year. That decision was tabled when a group of Colorado politicians waded into the process, urging the Forest Service to delay any action on the widely disliked proposal to allow even more scrutiny. For more information on all these stories, visit our website, www.coloradosun.com. And don't forget to tune in again on Monday. Before we go, we encourage you to check out a new podcast from our friends at KUNC called The Colorado Dream. Here's a sneak peek.
The new season of The Colorado Dream explores the Black immigrant experience in Aurora. It's told through the eyes of one African woman.
I would sit on the beach and just daydream about coming to America.
And the city of Aurora that's working to become an inclusive home for all.
In the last 20 years, we have a new face of the city.
I'm Stephanie Daniel. Join me for The Colorado Dream, Newcomers Welcome. You can find the series at KUNC.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
Now, a quick message from our editor.
I'm Larry Rickman, editor and co-founder of The Colorado Sun. The Sun is a public benefit corporation, and we rely on the support of listeners and readers like you to produce the nonpartisan, in-depth news that Colorado needs and deserves. Please consider becoming a Sun member for just $5 a month. Learn more at coloradosun.com. Thanks.